We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stocking. I'm joined by Corinne Lillis, Gary Porter, who's on the phone with us today, and Chuck Proctor. And today we're going to talk a little further about, well, what we did our discussion last Friday, which is the 17th Amendment and how it's been what I like to call the cancer to the problems that we're having today with Congress and a number of other issues that are going on. So we're going to continue that conversation today. But before we get into things, we actually, off of last Friday's program, received some emails from folks and about what we talked about with the 17th Amendment. We got into it quite heavily and plan to do a little bit more today. But some good email responses. And Corinne, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. And I want to remind our listeners that if they do want to email us, like other listeners we've received emails from, our email is info@1180wfyl.com.
Good. Good. Yes, we'd like to hear from you, get feedback from you, what you'd like to hear. We're trying to hit these topics that you're not going to get anywhere else because nobody else is talking about the Constitution. Well, they're talking about it, but they're not talking about it. But we are. Mm-hmm. And so, but how about that email that we got? It was from Paula, wasn't it?
Yes, this is from Paula. She wrote to us, she said, "Awoke later than usual, but was able to catch the tail end of your new program this morning for the first time. But although I missed most of it, I came away wanting to know more about the 17th Amendment and its impact on states' rights versus the federal government. Like the young lady on your program, I am sadly lacking in knowledge of all things constitutional. You and your program have awakened that realization and, in typical researcher mode, started me Googling like mad. I find as I get older, my curiosity has grown about many things that I previously ignored or took for granted. It's as though a whole new world has opened up for me, and I suppose it has a lot to do with being able to access information so readily on the computer without having to physically go to the source."
I think we're doing our job.
I think we are, too. And I'm glad, Paula, that we're on the same page.
Yes.
Makes me feel a little bit better.
But, now, that's a wonderful email on that about the program itself. Makes us feel good that we're accomplishing one of our many, many goals we have with the program.
Yeah, now, we want to put a spark. You know, we want listeners to go away wanting to learn more. You know, oh, I didn't know that. You know, what else do I need to know? Yeah. Can I talk to my friends about this?
And it helps, too, because we have a dynamite crew together here that we're talking about with the Constitution, all knowledgeable in it and providing a lot of good information out there. So hopefully, you know, there'll be more folks like Paula out there. And we did get another one from Phil, an email there. He, in his email, is a very lengthy email, but I'll just paraphrase some of the things in that. He talks about what Gary brought up was the 1828 Webster Dictionary, using the verbiage of the time and understanding the verbiage that was used in that document. Excellent resource, he points out on that one. And he's also, we touched on, and we're going to be touching a little bit more on this one, is the 16th Amendment. That's the one that deals with income tax. And it's very interesting because he says, you know, as convoluted as it is, we probably would want to avoid it because it would take up a whole entire hour. Well, that's why we're here, folks, is to take up as much time and many days or whatever it takes to get to these issues, to explain these issues for you to understand these issues. He goes on in his email and talks about, though, with the Constitution, that the original Constitution was an immoral document in that it denied rights and so forth to African slaves. Well, you know, I want to comment on that a bit, and which I will in a second. And the other part of his email, he talks about the ratification of an amendment in the Constitution based on our discussion last week. And what we had talked about last week, it might have been a little misunderstanding here, is the fact that to present an amendment to have the process begin. It takes two-thirds of the states or two-thirds of the House to present that amendment, but to ratify the amendment, it's going to be two-thirds to ratify. So a little clarification on that one that he has on. But, I mean, excuse me, it takes three-fourths. My mistake there. Three-fourths of the states to ratify the approved amendment. So it's two-thirds to bring forth and three-fourths to pass. So I want to be clear on that one. But a little comment I want to make about understanding the Constitution. It's kind of use it as your historic research guide, because after all, this is history that we're talking about. It's history that still pertains very much to today, of course. One of the common problems people have is taking 20th century values and apply it to an 18th century document or mindset. To understand the United States Constitution and how the Founding Fathers saw the world, you must understand the lives and culture of those days and must not make the mistake of applying our 21st century mindset and values to those of the past. To think that the founders omitted women and slaves from their document as the document being immoral is a falsehood statement, and it's based on applying modern day values to things of the past. Our founding fathers did grapple with the topic of slavery, but due to their culture, they were unable to address the issue in a way that would be acceptable to the populace of the day. You have to understand the culture of the people, how they lived. Although men from the Continental Congress who drafted the Declaration of Independence, to those who sat in the convention for the Constitution, knew that the issue should be addressed. One of the biggest problems with the Declaration of Independence getting it out was the debate over slavery. How can we say that all men are created equal and free, but we enslave? This was a discussion that they had, and they did not know exactly how to deal with it. Jefferson, Madison, Washington, and others were slaveholders but felt it should be abolished. But how? This is why they left the document, the Constitution, open for amendments, so that later generations could take it up and correct the wrong in which it was done. The 13th Amendment comes along that does abolish slavery. As for not including women, they are included. Now, this has been open by many in interpretation, biblical scholars and so forth, but the statement in which they refer, in which you'll see, the statement that says all men are created equal, in those days, the term men included women as well. It was a generic statement for all of us. Women, for the most part, in the 1700s could not own property, but many did in the United States. They are able to be considered to be included in the term men. So when we hear the term men, don't look at it very singular. It means men and women. To us today, this sounds very strange, but it's fact. So long from understanding history from those days, we must also take the time to understand how words were used and their meanings. Thus fits into what Gary talked about in that Webster's Dictionary. Check it out. It's fantastic. Really opens the light on things. I wanted to set a little ground rule to keep in mind while we're having these discussions. Understand the past. Don't apply our values net to the past, because it's entirely different. So quick little opening commentary there. Now, Chuck Proctor is in studio, and before we went on air, Chuck, you said you had some information concerning Conestoga Wood Specialties and the case in which you went in front of the Justices of the Supreme Court on. So, first of all, good morning, and I'll give you the mic for a while.
Good morning, Bruce. Good morning, Corinne. It's great to be here, of course, and appreciated your opening monologue there. I think there's a lot of meat in what you said in those few minutes, so let's be sure we get back to that. But I wanted to give everyone an update. The Hobby Lobby Conestoga Wood case, of course, gathered national attention. However, from a procedural standpoint, it's not over. And in spite of the fact that the Supreme Court gave us a ruling on June 30th, it was only yesterday that we received from Federal District Court here in Philadelphia a temporary injunction.
What?
Yes. Now, part of it's procedural because that's what we originally asked for. But
can you explain what that means, Chuck?
Well, a temporary injunction is something that would have, had it been granted, and we did get a two-week injunction initially 2 years ago. But it means that the government could not enforce the mandate while the litigation proceeded.
Mm-hmm.
We were not given the temporary injunction. Mm-hmm. We were not given the relief. And we kept kept asking for a temporary injunction, and that's what we took to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Supreme Court remanded it back to Third Circuit, and the Third Circuit remanded it back to Eastern District,
passing a bucket sounds like to me.
It was. It's quite from an attorney standpoint. It was a little comical, but we still had to deal with the temporary injunction. So we filed a motion to have our temporary injunction granted procedurally and then proceed with the case. And the judge scheduled a phone conference. The government did not oppose our motion, but they asked for a 30-day extension before either a permanent injunction or a final order was issued by the judge, and he granted it. So it's still not over. They couldn't give a reason why they wanted that extension. We know that they're coming out with some new rules and regulations on August 22nd, and keep your eye open for that to see what they're planning to do. We think they're going to try to throw in some type of accommodation, which is a broad term for, well, we'll accommodate the certain churches and religious groups. But
that would be complying then with the Supreme Court ruling.
You would think so. But there is nothing that they can really do that we're aware of. We haven't come up with any why they wouldn't say, hey, let's make this a permanent order, and why we wouldn't have made it a permanent order 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't until yesterday that we got that temporary injunction. And so the Hans at Conestoga Wood did not get their relief until August 14th.
Wow.
Even though the decision was June 30th.
Yeah, so.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe it's already been a month and a half.
Yeah.
So it sounds
to me like this is like base touching in a sense, because they missed that base, but to make sure they touch it for the record and getting the ducks in a row or the train cars in a row, even though you put your caboose in the middle of the stack of cars.
That's a very good analogy, Bruce, an excellent one. To a certain extent, I agree, we need to go through these procedures so that the record is clean and clear.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, we do not have a permanent order. We're another 30 days out. It'll be September 15th before we have another phone conference.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
theoretically, at that point, we either get our permanent injunction or an order of some sort from the court granting permanent recognition of what the Supreme Court did. And to me, on one hand, I appreciate the procedure part of it, but substantively for the government to say, hey, look, let's go ahead and get this done and get this over with. Meanwhile, they're filing motions and they're considering it. They won't tell us exactly what. It's just another example of the government they just won't give up.
Yeah.
And I appreciate their persistence.
Yeah.
Persistence is a virtue. But in this case, there is no other appeal. There is no other way to go other than to go by what the Supreme Court said.
Man, I realize Justice is blind, but I think she's getting a migraine headache right
now.
Oh,
man.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Well, you know, there is so much constitutional-wise, law-wise, that deals with Supreme Court and the Constitution. Don't ever think we're going to run out of material for this show.
And I want to welcome Gary to our program. He's on our phone lines waiting patiently. I'm sure he has much to say about what's been discussed. But Gary, what's your opinion about some things we've mentioned on so far?
Well, during Bruce's opening monologue, I wanted to point out that in the Constitution there was a provision to deal with the slave trade in a logical and orderly fashion. The Congress was prevented for 20 years from limiting that slave trade, but on the very first day that they were permitted to, they did. And so they did not waste any time in dealing with that. They knew it had to be dealt with, and they wanted to give the southern states time to hopefully deal with it on their own. But the moment that that restriction was lifted, they dealt with it on the very first day.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, good point on that. And these are some of the things, and Gary, you know this well, too, is that, you know, even for those that read the Constitution and do it on the train, let's say, riding in the work, or the bus riding in the work, and hopefully you're not doing it in the car driving in the work. But nevertheless, they don't tend to look at the little bit of the details of the thing versus the words and looking into it. So, and this is where what you are doing with your articles that you've been writing, that we've been looking at here, and of course being the executive director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, that you kind of dive right into those things, correct?
I would try to.
In fact, you did so with your recent article that came out, where you talked about the program last Friday, getting into the 17th Amendment, but and you also addressed something I want to follow today on the federalism within. A lot of folks don't realize what that is. Maybe you can give us a rundown.
Well, I was listening to a DVD myself just recently, and this commentator said you can understand the Constitution if you understand three concepts: federalism, enumerated powers, and separation of powers. If you understand those three concepts, 90% of the Constitution is in your belt. But the federalism concept is important because remember back to the Articles of Confederation, the states had all the power, Congress had little, if any, power. And
are you saying the good old days?
Well, it was the good old days in some respects. But as they approached the new Constitution, the states were quite protective of, and naturally so, of the sovereign power they enjoyed under the Articles of Confederation. They were not about to ratify anything that was going to seriously disrupt that power. And so they understood that their voice, the state's voice, would be in the Senate. And they would still be able to exert their sovereign powers through the Senate. So then they ratified the document. They encouraged the ratification, and it went forth. So for almost 150 years, perhaps, we operated under that premise that the states shared power with the national government, and they exerted that power primarily through their representatives in the Senate, the senators themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that got disrupted. That shared power concept is what we call federalism, and that got disrupted by the 17th Amendment.
Yeah, yeah. It's one would say, in looking even more into the 17th Amendment and the ripple effect that it's had throughout with states, with government, the Constitution in itself, literally became the fact that, hey, this is my spin. I'd like to get both of you gentlemen's opinion on this. Is one thing we talk about a lot today with the government and the way they do things, and of course, what's called the 17th Amendment, that cancer that caused the other diseases, is that it's all about control. Instead of having we the people the controlling factor, now it's the government going to be the controlling factor to control we the people. Your thoughts?
Chuck, you want to jump in?
Yeah, Gary, let me jump in there for a minute. I have a quote from Daniel Webster that I like to refer to often, and it is, "I am committed against everything which in my judgment may weaken, endanger, or destroy the Constitution, and especially against all extensions of executive power. And I am committed against any attempt to rule the free people of this country by the power and the patronage of the government itself." And over and over again, our founding fathers made the same statement in one form or another regarding the federal government taking the place of where the people were ruling themselves. And we see it today. Any program you've got, you can take education, for example. We have the federal government handing out federal money to schools and universities throughout the United States, and in so doing, those schools and those universities then, by accepting that money, have to abide by the regulations set up by the Department of Education. And whether it's Common Core or any other guideline, it's the federal government controlling the sovereignty of the people and of the states. And I know there are several colleges in the United States, not a handful, not many, that will not accept federal money for that very reason, because they do not want to be told that you cannot teach or educate your students, whether it's regarding the Constitution or religion or anything else. And it's a prime example. It's one that, you know, education's always brought up in an election. It's something that we have to look at and recognize that it's an intrusion on our sovereignty, on our space. And as Bruce said earlier, it started with the 17th, and it has spread to many other areas, and people don't even realize it. They don't realize what's happening, whether it's education, or we could take a dozen other areas where this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bruce, think of it this way. Political power is a zero-sum game. That is, there is a finite quantity of political power. And when the Constitution was ratified, there was a balance of that power between the national government, between the state governments, and the people. And any time that balance of power gets changed in any way, somebody lost and somebody gained. And as we look over the years since the ratification of the Constitution, the national government has only gained in power. And that had to be at the expense of the people or the states or both. There is no new political power being created out of nothing. It is a zero-sum game, and for one of those three parties to gain in power, it must be at the expense of one or more of the other two powers.
Right, and you know, you can equate it to when you get your new tires in your car. They balance those tires for they don't wobble, and for you get better mileage and better wear. And when you throw that balance off, you've got all kinds of problems that come just from the suspension, the tire wear, everything wear. It's amazing how one little thing out of kilter can just mess up the entire system. And that's kind of what we're looking at here, are we not?
Exactly. It is I mentioned in the article that you will not find federalism in the Webster's 1828, but you will find the word federal. And
yes.
The word federal in the Webster's refers to a compact, a contract between parties. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Constitution is. It put in place a compact between parties. And when one party wants to change the terms of that contract, it must get the consent of the other parties to the contract. Well, that has not been done.
Right.
Well, it legally was done in the sense that the 17th Amendment was ratified properly, but I don't think everybody that was party to the contract understood the ramifications mm-hmm. of that amendment when it was ratified.
Yeah, it's quite obvious, quite obvious. Well, we're going to, just a few, what do we got left here?
About
a minute.
Got
about a minute left. We're going to go to a break, and I want to, in your article, Gary, you talked about the Federalist, which I know was a political party. I believe Alexander Hamilton was one of the movers and shakers for the Federalist Party, where Jefferson is the creator of the Democratic-Republican Party. And I want to talk a little bit about the Federalists, because they were a short-lived political organization, and you wrote a little bit about it, mentioned it about it, and I want to kind of deal with that in there, because this whole thing, as you mentioned, with the Federalists, kind of is the gravitational field that gets the spin going here on this planet. And so I want to dive a little bit more into that one as well. So you up for that one when we come back?
Absolutely.
All right.
Gary, could you mention quickly where people could find your article if they wanted to read about it?
Well, I write these articles for a local paper here in Yorktown, Virginia, called the Yorktown Crier. And they have a website. I don't have it in front of me, but it's just yorktowncrier.com, some aspect of that. And after my columns are printed in the printed paper, then they're put on the paper's website, and so people can read them even though if they're not subscribed to the paper.
Okay, great. Thank you, Gary. All right, we will be right back. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, here on 1180 AM WFYL, working for your liberty.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. You know, there are many preambles to things that you read in the legal profession and a number of others, but I can't think of one more to the point in a punch that gets you going.
And read so well, Bruce.
Wow, forget the guy that read the thing on there. I don't know who he is. We're still trying to figure that one out. I think, Chuck, last week you said he just kind of snuck in here. But the fact is, the word, it's the words. Words mean a lot. And the way that was crafted, just fantastic, fantastic. You are listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, here on 1180 AM WFYL. I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And I'm joined with our contributors, Chuck Proctor from the Law Office of Proctor and Lindsay, and Gary Porter, the Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. So, and
Chuck looks like he's itching to say something, Bruce. I have to cut you off.
Bruce,
nothing like keeping an attorney you can't talk. See, they go crazy.
It's in our blood, I guess. You know, talking about that introduction, what are the first three words? We the people, not we the states, not we the Congress, not we the Senate, not we the President, we the people. And we have gotten so far away from that.
Oh, yeah.
That's the crux of it. And I think what Gary has hit on here, particularly with the 17th Amendment, is every little bit, and it's what we call in the courtroom the slippery slope, or at the Supreme Court, the parade of horribles. It's
I like that.
Well, Bruce, we could do a show on the parade of horribles.
Yeah.
If you Google it, just Google parade of horribles. It's fascinating.
That kind of goes along with what they call the Pentagon, the the puzzle palace.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, well, the Parade of Horribles comes from a New England tradition that started out as a 4th of July parade and has turned into
it's turned into the federal government.
Exactly.
Chuck, I also want to mention another one. We the People also doesn't say me the people. It's not about me. You know, it's very important with the we.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy to think about just yourself.
And I've pointed this out many, many times on It's a New Day and now on this program, too. On that document itself, it's just like John Hancock, when he signed the Declaration of Independence, he signed it very broadly for the king himself can read it without his spectacles. The same principle applies to the document because those are the biggest words you'll find written on that document. They're huge.
Mm-hmm.
And we the people, the power right there, that case closed. I closed my argument right there. That's who's got the power.
Maybe that's why we named this program We the People, the Constitution Matters.
Well, what I want to pick up on is with Gary's article that he wrote about our discussion last week and about the 17th Amendment, Gary, you mentioned the Federalists. Now, I know they're a political party. I think they died out in the 1820s and that, but talk to us about the Federalists. Who were these guys?
Well, it's kind of ironic, and I mentioned this in the essay, that the Federalists weren't really Federalists. They got the first pick of terms, and so they chose that term for themselves. But it was disingenuous because the Federalists were really nationalists. They wanted a strong national government. And the Anti-Federalists, who unfortunately were left to choose that term because there was none other left, were actually the Federalists, who believed in a shared power between the states and the national government. So, ironically, the Federalists were nationalists and the Anti-Federalists were Federalists.
That kind of makes sense because we are dealing with government here, you know. So, you know,
right.
It's a shell game, you know. But,
now, Ed, to elaborate, the Federalist Party that arose, as a result of the Constitution being ratified, really fell out of power after John Adams' term.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of went overboard in exerting their political strength, and when Jefferson came into power as the third president, the Federalist Party kind of began to wither at that point.
Yeah. Well, Chris, wasn't John Adams, I always look at John Adams as president, probably the first president to violate the Constitution, not to get off track here, but I think it's worth mentioning, for pushing the Alien and Sedition Act, which is a First Amendment violation, correct?
Yeah, I have never understood why there was why that was given such a blind eye by the Congress, other than the fact that the Federalists were in power and in the Congress, and this is something that John Adams supported, and they wanted to see it through. But Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were so horrified at the blatant unconstitutionality of that act, particularly the Sedition Act,
mm-hmm.
that they ghost wrote the Virginia and Kentucky resolves and set up the process, or at least the concept of nullification and interposition.
You mentioned the magic word there, nullification. Put that one on the list. That's another topic that I'd like to address that not many folks know too much about, because it hasn't successfully in a court of law worked yet, but it's a concept that's very fascinating. But, the fact with the Federalists in there, it wasn't primarily, we look at today. You get one particular party that wants to control the masses and the people, and the so-called Federalists were big government, taxation, everything that we kind of got away from fighting that war of independence. Am I correct?
Absolutely. And that's why they fell out of power, because they overreached,
mm-hmm.
is today's terms.
Yeah, it's... And, of course, Jefferson comes in. Jefferson's playing the game along with that, because I believe the man's name was Callender, who was a newspaper publisher that was writing pieces for Jefferson against Adams that brought all that on. And
yes, he was jailed, and when Jefferson came into power as president, he granted a pardon, and they even... repaid the fines that he had been subjected to.
Right. So when folks are looking at presidential constitutional violation, quite literally from the out of the gate is when it starts happening. Especially, it's really surprising with John Adams. Didn't like the negative press on him, therefore he passes he pushes through the Alien Sedition Act. But anyhow, that kind of fits in line with what the 17th Amendment does, is it's changing the Constitution to allow, which we have today, a one-party rule, where one party itself, you take a look at it, when Barack Obama becomes president, the Democrats have the House and the Senate, and what do? They jam the Unaffordable Health Care Act down our throats.
Bruce, can I read the 17th Amendment
again go ahead.
For our listeners if they don't know what it says?
Well, tell you what, Corinne, why don't you read the article that
I'll read
it corrects. And that would be Article 1, Section 3.
I know. I'm flipping through my little Constitution handheld book here. It's very convenient. Courtesy of Bruce. Okay. It says, "The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote." And then the 17th Amendment was ratified on April 8th, 1913, and it says that the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote.
Now, gentlemen, I'd like to ask you a question on this one. I think we talked about it last Friday. But again, for our listening audience out there, because the question comes to mind, why do you feel that they had to go through and change that article to make the Senate race a populist race instead of appointed by the states? What do you think the end game was here? I know, Gary, you just said that they probably didn't realize the total ramifications and problems that would come down the road, but why do you think this was done?
Well, there was a wave of populism. It began in the early 1800s, and it really gained strength in the early 1900s. And there were people who believed that the people didn't exert enough power in the government, and they wanted to make this change specifically to give the people more of a voice. But they did so, and, well, they didn't realize, I don't think, the ramifications of taking away the state's voice.
Mm-hmm. And, Garrett, I'd like to jump in on that from the standpoint of I think they also realized that there were political scientists out there back then, and even though they didn't have the fancy polling and data that we have today, they recognized that it wasn't hard to see that if you had a president, whether he's Republican or Democrat, the tendency of voters to follow the quote-unquote ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a huge political ramification to our entire system, so that as we see now, we have a Senate that's controlled by the Democrats. The House has changed over, and we're expecting, Lord willing, that the Senate will change this coming election. But they saw that following of voters, because it's much easier to go in there and vote the straight ticket. So if you like that president, you're going to vote for that Republican or Democratic senator as well.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as Bruce pointed out so capably that last week, the whole process was designed to make sure that there was some balance and some checks and on the power of the Senate through the system that was in place, and it's gone.
Yeah, and of course with this the 17th Amendment, and with that being gone, is, you know, we talked about the balance. I equated it to the new tire being balanced on your car. But when you get this unbalance, you get this divide. You know, we quite often hear them saying, well, I'm going to reach across the aisle, which, okay, what that comes down to, you take the chamber, the House and the Senate, divide it down the center, you got an aisle in which you walk down like in a movie theater to get to your seat. But Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other. But this has created such a divide, two camps, where now you look at it with the election going on or coming up in November, midterms, the Democrats are scrambling because, you know, using the words of Reverend Wright, the chickens are coming home to roost. Everything that they've done is coming after them. They're worried about losing the Senate now, and which then you still would end up with a one-party rule, being Republicans in the House and in the Senate as well, but the doesn't correct the situation of the unbalanced. Am I correct?
Absolutely, and look at it this way. Before the 17th Amendment, in order to enact any national policy, you had to pass that policy through both the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, getting that policy through the Senate required that you convince the state legislatures of all the states. That's thousands of individuals who had to vote to instruct their senators whether to pass or to pass or vote against that particular piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's no longer the case. Now you only have to convince the 51 senators themselves to pass a particular piece of legislation. So it's now much, much easier for one party to dominate the political landscape.
Well, exactly. And I think also what we're dealing with, again, is another byproduct of this infection, is what you just said. You have to convince those senators. where the House of Representatives and the Senate, and Chuck, jump in on this one because it fits into you, because those two would be literally like your attorneys, is that you have hired these individuals to represent you if you're the state legislator or if you're the individual who voted. You have discussion on the proper way of doing it. Do you think it works and that? Then they go to the floor and they work in accordance to their clients. And now that the client is basically, yeah, well, you know, they'll have to accept it. This is the way they're looking at it. Am I right on that?
You're absolutely right. And, of course, I think the citizens have given up a lot of their voice and their power, except at the ballot box, which, and again, that's a whole subject for another day. But I've had state legislators tell me as few as 5 people come to their office to see them, they'll change their vote on a matter.
Yeah.
That's how little it takes, because we're not engaged.
Of course, it depends on if they're up for election that year, too. That's the only time they'll
exactly.
do anything for the
exactly.
constituency.
And the other thing, Gary, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you look at Article 1, Section 3, the second paragraph, where it talks about the fact or creates the system where a third of our senators are elected sequentially, that as I understand it, when they're talking about the 17th, they wanted to eliminate that too. They wanted to have them all consolidated into one vote at one time, and that did not make the cut. But I you may have more information on that than I do, and that would have been absolutely disastrous.
Oh.
Well, I haven't encountered that, but it doesn't sound foreign. I mean, it does sound something like like someone enamored with a democracy would certainly support. And, of course, as we all know, the founders, the drafters of the Constitution, were definitely not fans of democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, of course, that's another good word that we keep hearing, and it's thrown around every time when they talk about the United States. Oh, we're the greatest democracy in the world. You had FDR. Well, the arsenal of democracy. We're a republic. A representative republic. And perhaps, gentlemen, you can help our audience out a little bit on this, because it's not wordsmithing, but words mean, again, how important they are. What is the difference between a republic and a democracy? I'll throw that one out at you guys. Gary, you want to take a shot at
it? Well, a democracy is ruled by the 51%. Regardless of what the rights of the 49% are, the 51% prevail. That's pure and simply a democracy. And as the founders studied the governments of old, they found that democracies never last. Mm-hmm. They always eat themselves up from within. The trite saying is that as soon as 51% realize they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury, then everything will go downhill from there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like that quote we do here in the program every now and then, is that when the republic will be in danger when Congress figures out they can bribe the people with their own money.
Mm. Yes, right.
You know, the other thing, Gary, about a republic, if you look at it from a Daniel Webster dictionary type of approach, it also excludes the concept of a king or a monarch or an emperor or someone who has absolute authority, and in addition to giving that power to the people. And I think that's a key concept here, and we've talked, we've touched on it briefly in previous programs about what's happening in the White House today, where, hey, I have my phone and my pen, so I can do what I want attitude. And that is not our republic form of government. And people are just saying, well, we need to get things done in Washington. No, we don't. We need to get things done at home and stop relying on Washington to get them done for us.
Well, I think Thomas Jefferson said it should be more of a priority to enforce the laws than to make them, and which is a dead-on accurate statement. But let me ask you this. Corinne, jump in as well. Is why do you think they glom onto, be it the media, be it our elected employees, why do you think they gravitate and glom onto the word democracy all the time instead of republic.
Wow, that's a good question.
Is it because the fact that democracy sounds so nice, so stellar, so, you know?
Honestly, Bruce, I didn't even think about that till you mentioned that they do say that word all the time over the word republic. That
a democracy is great when you're part of 51%.
Yeah.
But if you're not, if you're part of the 49%, democracy doesn't work very well.
Yeah, well, yeah, you've got a good point there.
Well, I want to know if our listeners, what their opinion is. This question is for the listeners as well. Email us info@1180wfyl.com. Or if you want to call us quick, our number, our toll-free number is 800-667-1180.
Yeah, and this is not a new thing. This is something that has been around for a long time. There is the Democratic Republic, which is, could that be the reason? You know, Democrat, democracy, oh, they sound so close.
Well, Bruce, I liken it to the acronym for the ACLU, in that the American Civil Liberties Union.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds so good.
Yeah.
It sounds so wonderful. Here it's American, it's civil, it's liberties, it's a union. But if you really look at the foundation, the history of the ACLU and the people that started it and what their goals were, and I've sat with attorneys from the ACLU, they don't even understand themselves what it really is, what their purpose is. They're just
because
it sounds good.
Yeah.
And I myself, when I was in high school and college, I thought, oh, boy, that must be a great organization.
Yeah.
It wasn't until later on that I realized where they were coming from and what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say this. There have been times, as you know, I'm an Alliance Defending Freedom allied attorney. There have been times when there have been cases that we have worked with the ACLU. There was the case up in Alaska with the boy with the T-shirt. We were hand in hand with them.
Yeah.
But for the most part, and again for another show, I could tell you stories about things that I've heard from attorneys of the ACLU that we might not, Kern might have to bleep me out because it's just shocking where they're coming from, and nobody appreciates the fact that there was the lady that started this in the 1920s, I believe, she was a flat out communist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No
question. Well, you know, and I always look at like the ACLU as a hot water heater going bad. Sometimes it runs hot, sometimes it runs cold. And sometimes they come up with something to support something that's like, yeah, well, yeah, that's good. But most times they come up with, what? You know, and it's constitutional attacks.
And it's an uneducated, knee-jerk reaction to whatever's going on around them. For instance, I heard this morning on the way up on the news feed that they filed two lawsuits in Missouri over the situation over there. One for the release of information from the police, and the other related to I forget what the second one was, but knee jerk reactions.
Yeah.
Don't give anybody any time to solve the problem or address the problem. Right. Let's just jump into it.
Yeah,
and of course, we could talk about peaceably addressing your grievances to the government contained in the first paragraph of the First Amendment, but that's another subject.
Yeah. Wasn't Judge Ginsburg a former ACLU attorney? I think
she was. She was chief counsel for the ACLU.
I just thought I would throw that in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
I want to ask you gentlemen a question. We're hoping that our listeners take a lot away from this Constitution program, but what do you guys think that our listeners, if there's maybe a couple main points our listeners should know about the 17th Amendment, what's important for them to understand about it, just to kind of summarize it? And
on that, because it will give us some fodder for a future show. The 17th Amendment is now part of the Constitution because the states asked for it. The states began passing resolutions calling on Congress to pass the 17th Amendment. Now, I think that's the greatest example of shooting oneself in the foot, but that's another issue. But when the states reached the point where 31 of them had called for this amendment, Congress finally acted. They had been dragging their heels, particularly the Senate, and Congress finally acted to propose the amendment so they could circumvent a constitutional convention that would propose the amendment and the risk there of a, quote, runaway convention. So that's another issue, the issue of a runaway convention or amending the Constitution via conventions of the states. That's another issue for another day, but it's certainly where we could go in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Chuck, your thoughts on that?
Well, I concur with Gary on that, that we're looking at a situation where the people that propose this, although we've seen a lot, we've heard a lot, their true intentions weren't put out there.
Yeah.
And I think even though the grassroots approach may have come from the states, there was something more behind that approach. And that was a designed piece of legislation that they wanted to get through with this amendment. They wanted to avoid that constitutional convention. And if you look at the closeness of which the 16th Amendment was passed and our internal subsequent Internal Revenue Code, I think that this is, and again, that's for a future date, I think there's a very, very clear connection between the two of them.
Yeah, and of course, how was the bill of goods was sold, as I call it, was by the Minutemen, Woodrow Wilson and his party that did the soapbox and sold this bill of goods. It's probably one of the biggest snow jobs to take place ever in the history of the United States.
Bruce, a quick comment on Woodrow Wilson. Because of the timing and because of the international situation with World War One and what have you, a lot of attention got diverted away from what was going on internally. Gee, does that sound familiar today?
History repeating itself?
Yes.
That's a good point. Very good point.
I was with someone the other day, very, very knowledgeable person, and something came up about missing documents. And we all made a reference to IRS missing documents, and the person didn't even know what we were talking about. And this is a well-educated person that watches the news and what have you. It had gone right over their head.
Well, look at it this way. If it was in an email, they would have lost it that way, the IRS. and I think you've got other things that are doing it. Well, gentlemen, that hour went by again.
Want to give a little quick preview of what we'll talk about next week?
Yeah. Gary, any thoughts?
Well, we could launch into the 16th because I think you're chomping at the bit on that.
Yeah, I do want to kind of finish up next Friday, maybe the first part of the show with Sam Rohr will be back and 17th Amendment. He has some thoughts on that. And, of course, next week that Chuck Proctor won't be with us. So, be safe wherever you're going, what you're doing. We're looking forward to seeing you back.
Unfortunately, I'll be out of range. And since it's our 42nd wedding anniversary, I think I won't be calling.
It's a
either.
Higher calling for you that day, so fully understand. But for all of us here at We the People, Constitution Matters, I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And for Chuck Proctor and Gary Porter, thanks for listening. Tune in next week. The conversation continues on.
For listening.
The execution of the laws is more important than the making of them. Thomas Jefferson, 1789.